if you had to be honest and look into your heart of hearts, would you say that you and I, we go together just like peaches and cream?
This isn't another fucking Michael McDonald song, is it?
No, but it could turn into one. Very quickly.
No, stop it. No,
all right,
there's
I'm sorry.
Michael McDonald in this fucking movie.
I know.
None.
I guess I keep forgetting.
Stop.
Damn it. Sorry.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Junk Food Cinema, everybody. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, Cash. And joining me, of course, is the tango to my Cash, novelist slash screenwriter slash lieutenant in Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
You almost forgot that one.
I almost did, but then I remembered how I never hear the end of it if I forget it, so did not forget it. Rebounded. You guys can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, we are closing the book on Buddy Cop July and doing it in...
Taking away our badges and our guns.
We have to put our badges and our guns on the table, walk out defiantly. We'll probably still stay on the case because we're rogue. So we're closing out in a really tremendously odd, wonderful fashion with this week's film, which is a 1974 oddity called Freebie and the Bean.
How do you get up in the morning?
Apologize about my gun.
You apologize to this.
Apologize about my gun. I apologize about your lip.
You're not fit to guard the fish at the aquarium.
Easily the most racist title we have ever reviewed.
Yes.
Like, you cringed last week when I mentioned White Dog.
Yeah.
And yet we're covering Freebie and the Bean, and it was your idea.
Yes. That being said, that's my least favorite part of the movie is the title. So Freebie and the Bean is a film that was directed by Richard Rush, who you guys may know from the movie Stuntman. I was never really a big fan of Stuntman, but I know it's got like a following. It's got like one of those sort of Criterion type followings. But this is a film about two San Francisco police detectives who are trying to bust and then for the rest of the movie protect a local mafia guy. It's hilarious. They go to great lengths to try and bust him, and then they realize halfway through their investigation, when they think they're pretty close to nailing him, they find out, somebody's coming down from Detroit to kill him, which pisses them off because it's like, no, damn it, we've been working on this case. We're not just going to let somebody kill him. And then the DA basically makes them a deal that, you know, if they can protect this mob guy from getting killed before their witness. They apparently have this witness who's coming into town who is going to make their case against this guy. So all they have to do is keep him alive long enough for the witness to show up, and then all the pieces will be in place, and then they can put this guy away.
And that is literally the entire plot of the fucking movie.
And that's the entire plot of the movie.
It is the thinnest threads holding this movie together.
Except when we get to the end, which we'll talk about, where they start throwing a lot of shit at you all at once, and you're like, whoa, wait, what's going on? Wait, what is that? Wait, when did this get so complicated? And then it's just over. It's like they try and introduce a lot of depth right at the end, not like gradually throughout, but like right at the end, they try and throw all of this narrative depth at you, and you're like, none of this gels. You are introducing a lot of things that were not, you know, earned by anything up until this point. But it doesn't matter because the two cops are played by Alan Arkin and James Caan.
Which is the whole fucking reason to watch this.
Absolutely.
Like if that line right there, if that sentence didn't make you want to watch this, you were listening to the wrong fucking podcast.
And
the
you may be dead.
Fact that this is literally 2 hours of James Caan and Alan Arkin busting each other's balls in rapid fire succession.
Mm-hmm.
This is the whole reason to see this movie. It is the proto buddy cop movie. It is the buddy cop movie upon which all other buddy cop movies were based.
Yeah.
And it is the oddest fucking buddy cop movie.
It is really, really weird. I know
the best way to describe it is it's Altman-esque. You know, this comes out of the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were being very experimental with, you know, style and structure. And this movie literally opens with these two guys just busting each other's balls incessantly. And you're like, who the fuck are these guys? These guys fucking hate the shit out of each other. Why are they dumping trash into the back of their car and sifting through it? And you eventually realize that these two are cops and that these guys are partners. And they're called Freebie and the Bean because James Caan is Freebie, a cop who's constantly using his power to get free shit.
Yeah.
He's literally this guy who's looking forward to becoming a vice cop because of all the graft.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole point of him becoming a vice cop, is he wants to get all this cash flowing in. And then you've got the Bean, who's called Alan Arkin, who's called the Bean because why, Brian?
Because his partner is a fucking racist. And
Alan Arkin is playing a Mexican-American.
Which is funny to me that, like, I don't know which is more racist. The fact that James Caan is ragging on Alan Arkin for being Mexican, or the fact that the movie thinks that we're going to believe that Alan Arkin is a Mexican. I don't know. I don't know which is more racist in that equation, but yes, because we've talked in episodes past about the cops in these movies kind of being dicks, like being like how good cop and bad cop can be simultaneously one person, and how we may like them, we may enjoy watching their exploits, but they're not by the book in any. And by the book, I mean Miranda rights. They are not following protocol whatsoever. They're
well-intentioned at the very least.
No, these two make all of the other bad cops we've talked about look like fucking choir boys.
Yeah.
These guys
are bad cops.
The reason the movie has the title it has is because one of them steals and the other one is Mexican, and therefore the one who steals rips on him constantly throughout the movie. And not just Beaner, like every slur you can imagine gets thrown out as if it's just casual friendly banter.
Yeah.
And
it's done as casual friendly banter. But the thing is this screenplay is written like a play.
Mm-hmm.
The dialogue in this, it's theater. And that's what's so fascinating about it, is this movie never lands on a joke and lets it sit so that you can take it in. It's just throwing jokes at you.
Yes.
And it is very disconcerting at first. It's not a movie for everyone because the rapid fire nature of it, a lot of people are just like, what the fuck is this? And it's a very hard movie to get into.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're someone who appreciates performances, if you're someone who loves watching something new and oddball and different, this movie is so up your alley, because ultimately what this movie is it's a couple of bad cops trying to make this big bust and then fucking up constantly.
Yeah.
Like constantly. And ultimately at the end of the day, having been on such the wrong track and not even knowing and realizing what big stooges they are.
Yeah.
That it just kind of blows the movie out of the water. It's such a weird little oddity.
Yeah. And a part of it comes from the fact that the movie that Alan Arkin and James Caan want to be in is not the movie that this set out to be. And there is something kind of adversarial, not just between the two of them, but between the two of them and the tone of the rest of the movie. Like, they really do feel like they don't give a fuck what is going on in the rest of the movie. They're in the movie that they want to be in. And if those two things don't line up, well, then fuck you. And it's funny because evidently the director wanted this to be a really wacky, really stunt-heavy type of movie.
Yeah.
And Alan Arkin and James Caan wanted this to be a movie that focused more on the characters. So what they would do is they would actually get together for improvisation sessions, and they would practice just riffing, and then they would get to set, and that's what they would do. So if it feels like these two guys are kind of at odds with the rest of the movie, it's because these two guys were kind of at odds with the rest of the movie. But I think that's what makes the things about this movie work, is these two and just the, like you said, the rapid fire jokes between them. And it's sometimes it's almost as if they're mumbling, you know, it's almost as if they're just like, they're just trying to, it's like they're making jokes through their teeth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because it's these guys, they very much seem like they're constantly just kicking each other in the balls and grasping at whatever straws they have,
mm-hmm.
just to see if they can get the other person's goat.
Yeah.
And what it may have been was they were both trying to bust each other up. I mean, it might have been that kind of a thing where, you know, both actors are like, I'm going to be the one who says the line that gets you to crack up, and
right.
you won't be able to come back. And so this is what fills all the quiet space in the movie. During the scene in which they're on the stakeout, and they're sitting in the car where ordinarily you'd have some quiet moments and maybe there'd be a quick exchange. Instead, they're literally cracking jokes from the minute the scene cuts in to the point at which the bean goes, hey, that car's got Michigan plates. And then it's like, okay, the movie can go on again, and Richard Rush gets his movie back, and we get to have a very Richard Rush-esque scene. but before then, it was literally these two guys just riffing and being racist and being horrible to one another in all the best ways and all the most interesting ways.
Yeah, I mean, let's go to another stakeout scene just to kind of illustrate how weird this movie is. There's a scene where they're outside the guy's house at night. Typically in this situation, if you're on a stakeout, you try to make as little noise as possible because you don't want anyone to know that you're there. Instead, James Caan notices that Alan Arkin has fallen asleep. He gets out of the car, and he just starts yelling, quick, quick, they're entering the house, go, 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 and freaks Alan Arkin out, and then starts laughing. And then they proceed to chase each other around a playground.
And beat the crap out of each other.
Like, it's suddenly a Beatles, you know, music video. Like, what the fuck is happening? And that's the whole thing, is, like, these guys are terrible goddamn cops.
Oh, yeah.
Just terrible. And I think it's really true what you said about, like, when they get to the end of the movie, when all the weird stuff starts getting introduced, it's like the audience doesn't have any clue what's going on because the two people who should be investigating this and helping us slowly figure out what's going on were so far off track and so far up their own asses that we don't even have any idea what's going on by yeah. the end of this movie. We have had no clues because the two detectives we're following haven't found any. Because they're too busy ripping on each other
yeah.
and, you know, taking suits from tailor shops that they're threatening to, like, oh, your exit's blocked. That's going to be a big fine. Oh, I really like this jacket. Yeah, that's going to be a big fine. It's just like, God damn it, Freebie. But, yeah, this film was kind of troubled from the onset. Like, again, we talked a little bit about the animosity between, you know, what it was that Alan Arkin and James Caan were looking for as opposed to what the director here was trying to put together. Both of them at various points during the movie threatened to quit. They both thought Richard Rush was focusing too much on the action, not enough on the characters. And then there was also a really tense situation where you may remember early in the film, they're going up that that construction site elevator.
Yeah.
Well, it got stuck. And so the two of them are in that in the elevator with Laszlo Kovacs, who's the DOP on this film, and they're just stuck. And eventually they have to jump down from that elevator to the next floor and then walk down 65 flights of stairs. Thing is, James Caan already afraid of heights. So you have and then you have an 11-week shoot that was frequently delayed by rain. And so you just...
In
San Francisco,
I know. That's so weird.
It's crazy. And then you have... Because of all that, because of all the tension going on, because of the various problems, Alan Arkin stated in an interview afterwards that he only took this role because he needed a paycheck, but to this day believes the movie is absolute garbage. Like, those are his words. He thinks the movie is absolute garbage. I mean, I guess one man's absolute garbage is this podcast's bread and butter, but for the record, I could not disagree more with Arkin. I don't think this movie is garbage whatsoever. I think it's bizarre. I think it does a lot of things that you couldn't possibly get away with now. But the movie, what drives this movie for me isn't so much the stunt work, which, you know, is definitely what sold it in the marketing, but that back and forth between Arkin and Khan.
Yeah, which is at times magical.
Yeah, it really is. Like when, even in those moments where James Khan is being so horrendously offensive, there's just something about the way that they play off of each other that you can believe both sides of their relationship. You can believe that there really is, an amiability between the two of them, and you can believe that they want to fucking kill each other. And it's like, no, I get that. Like, every facet of that works for me, and you know, and I think that's what makes it so enjoyable. Is just those two guys being completely and utterly over the top with, I don't know how much they dig on each other, or how much they rip on each other.
To their credit, the parts of this movie that don't work are Richard Rush's films.
Yeah.
You know, his film, you know, there's this really great, you know, what he does really well is there's some really great car chases in here.
Oh my God, so much mayhem.
There's so much mayhem. And watching the two guys deal with those car chases is really kind of fun.
Yeah.
Until, like, there's one moment that really highlights the difference between the two films that were being made simultaneously, in which we go from this really amazing car chase where we're watching what Freebie is really good at. Like, Freebie has a supernatural ability to, when he gets cut off, when he gets fucked out of chasing a guy, to very calmly turn around, take another way, and come out right behind him somewhere else because he knows where this guy's going. He just knows, and he knows his city, and you're just like, that's so badass. And every time he does it, it's so cool. And there's one scene in particular where it's so well done. And just it all comes together, and it's got this amazing shot where you see the two cars kind of converging at once after having taken different routes, and to do so perfectly. And then they end up losing control of the vehicle inexplicably, driving off the side of a bridge and driving into someone's apartment, where they're just sitting calmly eating their dinner in bed. And not reacting. And then you get what is this really just kind of ham-fisted comedy until they get out of the car. And then we get into the character stuff again, where every time these guys fuck up, these tough-talking, brash, like machismo, you know, dripping cops all of a sudden become very quiet and very, and James Caan's like, oh, I'm very, very, very sorry about the wall. And, you know, this bit of him calling for a tow truck, and he's like, yeah, we're 16 something street, apartment 3B on the third floor.
It's the third floor. And we're going to need a tow truck.
And it's really good. So all the character comedy in that sequence is working, but all the big broad stuff is just like so silly and out of place with the grit of the car chases and the grit of the character work that it's just like,
what were you going for?
Early 60s comedy. Did you think you were making It's a Mad, 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 Mad World? Like, what is this?
Actually, with the amount of cars they destroy, I think they thought they were making It's a Mad, 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 Mad Max, because this movie has, I believe the director said, it's about 4 car chases and 100 wrecked cars. Like, absurd amount of destruction.
Well, and it gets absurd. Like, there's one time where one car, like, smashes into another car, and every other car turns and smashes into each other. And all of a sudden, some car comes flying over the camera inexplicably.
Yeah.
Smashing down. It's like, where the fuck did that come from? Like,
yeah.
There was no way for that car. Fuck it. They were just like, let's blow some shit up.
It's like in the Blues Brothers. You know, where it's like one car stops and then like 50 cop cars start piling up on top of each other.
Yeah, it's but without the absurd comedy that goes with it. Like, you're supposed to, like, in that moment, it's supposed to be a serious chase.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be a badass crash. And it's like, you just started throwing cars at it.
Yeah. Like you were James Wan making Furious 7, just start throwing cars at the screen. No, but it's weird, too, because in that moment before they crash into, which, by the way, that was the moment they used to sell the movie. Like, that was the big hook of all the trailers. That was the thing to get people, was the car crashing into the building. And right before that happens, when they lose control of the car, they pull this, like, Three Stooges shit.
Yeah.
Where they're, like, they look at the camera, James Caan lets go of the wheel and, like hugs Bean. He's just like, oh, God, what's going
to
happen?
That's what I'm talking about. Like nothing that this guy has done to the whole movie would lead you to believe that he would ever do that.
Especially since the thing that we've established he's good at is driving in frantic situations.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, if you just hit the brake, or you could act like there's a ghost or like some other cartoon trope and like just grab the person next to you and it's like, well, I guess we're going off this bridge now. It's really bizarre.
Yeah.
And I think, I think that's why we keep saying there are two movies going on here. There is the movie that was intentionally intended by Richard Rush, and then there's the movie that it became because of the two people he cast. And I don't think this movie works 1 yard without the two people in it being so hatefully against what it's trying to be, which is such a, like, that cannot happen in movies.
Yeah.
Like, when you have actors who are actively working against the film, it never leads to a positive outcome.
Except
here. It's mind-boggling a little bit. Like, this movie should not work at all.
Yeah, but that's just it. If these cops were good cops, that this movie might not work. But then we get to that ending.
Yeah.
Where we find out that these cops didn't brilliantly stumble upon evidence. They found evidence that was left for them.
Yeah. Because
they were being so obvious about what they were doing. The wife of the criminal, who's sleeping with their boss, the police chief, has left this clue so they can send him upriver for 3 to 5 years with time off. So she has the excuse to get away from him. She can divorce him and she can then marry this police chief.
Which, by the way, all of this is being thrown at us in the last 5 minutes of the movie. Like, it's a telenovela during sweeps week. They're throwing all the twists at us at once.
Yeah. It's Sally Kellerman shows up.
Yeah.
And it's just like, hey, here's all the exposition that explains the entire movie.
Well, here's all the exposition. The movie doesn't feel explained because we've been following Freebie and Bean, who are, turns out, terrible cops. We have not been keeping up at all with what's been going on. We've been busy murdering people in bowling alley bathrooms and having this whole side plot about Bean's wife possibly, maybe not cheating on him.
Valerie Harper.
Valerie Harper, Rhoda herself.
Yeah, Rhoda playing a very, very racist portrayal.
Yeah, almost as racist as Alan Arkin being called Bean.
Almost.
So much just...
Well, this movie is insensitive as fuck.
Oh, yeah.
This movie is very 70s. I mean, there, you know, one of the main villains in the movie turns out to be this very, very flamboyant homosexual man.
Yeah.
Who's actually played by a woman during certain scenes.
Yeah, I was like, okay, I know that sometimes transsexuals, people who dress in drag, can look very convincing. But I'm 100% sure that was a woman a scene ago.
Yeah.
I'm 100% sure that was a woman a scene ago.
He's constantly referred to as the Fruit Loops and the Fairy.
Yeah.
Like, he's never, you know, I don't even know if he has a name, but because it's just all the slurs coming out of Freebie.
Yeah.
Like, he's just, dude, just like, he takes it so far. And in this day and age, like, this is a movie you couldn't make in this day and age.
No, and like, nor should you.
Get away with this movie. Like, just the title alone would get you in hot water. And then when you have the portrayal of the gay man, it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
But the thing is it works for what it is. And it's really kind of funny at one point where, you know, where Alan Arkin just like he's like, you're just full Archie Bunker. and it's just like, yeah, that's exactly like he decided to play this as Archie Bunker. Like, that's the character. The character is Archie Bunker as a cop. And it's and I feel like they use that to deflect because they really did go really far, and they're like, hey, you're just a stereotype. And the audience goes, oh, yeah, he's just a stereotype. That's not a real cop. That's just a joke movie cop. And it's kind of like, this is really kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they really are very wanton with the violence and with the theft.
Yeah, and not only that, but just, like, some of their interior, like, their version of good cop, bad cop. This sums up these two on a professional level like no other scene in the movie. They are interrogating a witness, and the interrogating consists of Alan Arkin reading Miranda rights one line at a time, and after he finishes each one, James Caan goes up and slaps the guy in the face. And then he tries to do it again, and Alan Arkin's like, no, I'm not done reading him his rights yet. And he slaps him again. Like, that to me sums up these two. It's like, once the feigned attempt at following procedure has even started after they've been throwing this guy around the entire apartment, it is still followed by him getting slapped in the face. Like, these two are complete and utter douchebags. And in fact, I have to believe that the plot point about a douchebag during the is my wife cheating on me or not sequence has to be a reference to the fact that these two are huge douchebags. I can't imagine any other reason why.
Know, the thing in the closet.
The thing, your thing is gone. Where was your thing? And it's like, well, when a douche has three holes in it, it's salvageable. But when it has four holes, there's more going out than in. Just very interesting dialogue scene.
The movie is full of uncomfortable moments.
So many uncomfortable moments. Like, and the thing is, nobody told the composer when those uncomfortable moments are supposed to be, because there's that song that plays through the whole movie, like, you and me, babe, we go together just like peaches and cream. It's like the silly little, you know, kind of sounds a little, what's it, Marvin Hamlish? Is that the guy who did the music for The Sting, or is that the guy from Clash of the Titans? Which one? Harry Hamlin, Marvin Hamlish. Marvin Hamlish. I always get those two confused. It's weird, two people to get confused, but yeah, it has that kind of like jauntiness, and they keep playing it in scenes where it's like, no, this is actually a really uncomfortable. Are you just going to start it? Okay, well, I guess the song's playing now, which to me is kind of illustrative of the fact that nothing in this movie really gels together, like other than Arkin and Caan, who spend most of the movie making fun of each other, insulting each other, or at one point literally kicking each other's asses, and yet they gel better than any other two elements of this entire movie. Even though you have two characters who seemingly hate each other at points, they still work together better than any other two elements in this movie.
Yeah, you know, the movie that I can most compare this to is another one of our favorites, The Long Goodbye.
Yeah.
I mean, just in being unafraid to mumble, and mm-hmm. just the way the dialogue's laid out, and just the surreal nature of the narrative, like these films feel like, you know, connected in some way, like or very inspired by, like, maybe that was the thing, because The Long Goodbye is what, 72?
I believe so. It was very early 70s.
I want to say, like, that might be something that, you know, Arkin and Caan had watched and been like, you know what this needs to be? It's 74?
73. It's a year before this came out. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it might be one of those things where they're like, let's make that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how great would that be? I want to make that movie instead of this zany, you know, cop movie.
Instead of a movie where it's insinuated at one point that one of James Caan's interrogation techniques is rape. Like, there's this whole scene where they're in the apartment, and he's like, well, I'm going to go question the girl. Maybe she knows something. And the guy they're interrogating is like, what's he doing to her? And Alan Arkin says, I don't know. It's different every time. And then you go in there, and he's like tying her hands up with a belt. And she's like,
the thing is she was playing along.
I mean, she was playing along, but it's like, where did this idea even come from, if not from previous experience? Like, this is a really just, again, there's no reason we should like these two characters, except for the way they interact with each other. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's that they're both such enormous douchebags that it works watching them cut each other down, because it's like, at least somebody in this movie is telling these assholes where to go. It just happens to be each other.
But then at the end of the movie finds its soul.
It does.
In a beautiful way, because You know, they've got this build up. They've got the guys dead to rights. You know, Bean opens the door. They've got him, and he gets shot.
Yeah.
He goes down, and we think he's dead.
Yeah.
And there's this moment where James Caan is just kind of reeling. You've literally just spent the last hour and 45 minutes watching him tear this guy apart, like, just, like, hating on him. And he's lost.
Yeah.
Like, there's this
moment. He doesn't know what to do.
And it's really interesting what they do with the cinematography and the score at that point. Like, he's literally lost. Like, you realize that this is his significant other. Like, they both have wives, but neither of them are connected to their wives because their significant other is their partner.
Yeah.
And it's just such a profound, soulful moment. And you're just like, oh, fuck, man. Jesus. And then we have, you know, the final scene and the crushing weight all comes down. You're like, man, this movie got heavy really fucking quick.
Yeah.
Like, because all of a sudden everybody's coming down on Freebie because they were, you know, because Freebie's just like mouthing off. And he's like, we had your husband dead to rights and now he's dead. And I'm really sorry, but we were going to send him away. And Sally Kellerman's just like, you didn't have nothing, you ignorant fucking cop. You had what? You found a piece of paper in the trash and you think you had him? Who the fuck do you think put it there? And you're just like, oh, and the look on his face, and he's just lost his partner and he's realized that he thought he was this big tough guy about to make this big break. And it was, and like literally just everything's like slipping through his fingers at the moment. It's just, and then his captain comes down on him and his captain reveals how he was involved in the whole thing. You're just like, what the fuck? And like, you know, there's a shot of flags waving in the background. It's all blurry and blurring out. And you're just like, what? Like, this guy
taking place at the Super Bowl, by the way.
This guy's fucking losing it.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so, you know, and then he drives away in the ambulance. You're like, fuck, man. This movie went dark hard. And then Bean wakes up and he's like, I want a taco.
And they never explain. Wait, why?
Because the paramedics are as bad as their cops.
Apparently so. Apparently in 1974 in San Francisco, everyone was terrible at the job that they had. That is the lesson to take away from this movie, is if it was the 70s and you were in San Francisco, everybody was bad at what they were supposed to be doing. Everybody. Even the two robbers trying to steal a truckload of whiskey. They're terrible drivers. Oh, obviously, yeah. That truck flips over and Freebie steals a couple bottles of the whiskey because he's Freebie. But yeah, that ending goes to so many weird places that I'm like, what would the rest of the movie had looked like if that had been the tone of the whole movie? Or if there were any kind of signposts, any kind of breadcrumbs that would have led us to that kind of tonal shift. But instead, it hits you like a truck. Because it really comes out of nowhere, and then they abandon it. They just give up on it.
I don't think they abandoned it so much as they needed an upper ending, and so they've got them wrestling around in the ambulance as the ambulance drives off the road, and we roll the credits, and peaches and cream. And it's like, wow, that was really heavy, and now we're back to the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Like It you can really feel that was not one of their moments. That was Richard Rush's movie again.
Yeah.
Like, and it's so just fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
And yet it's so watchable. Like it's a spectacular failure that succeeds in its failure.
Yeah.
At two guys trying to make a different movie. Like it's such a fascinating, wonderful clusterfuck that I think is a really good movie.
Yeah, despite itself. Like, despite everything that it failed to do, and it's despite the fact that you have two leads who could not give less of a shit about the intention of the filmmaker, about what the movie was supposed to be.
And two legends, by the
way. Legends, absolute legends.
The thing is that if this were two unknown actors, you know, who are trying something. Like, at this time, they weren't even unknowns, but they weren't the legends they are now. But you look back and you're like, who the fuck is Richard Rush? But I sure as fuck know who James Caan and Alan Arkin are.
I mean, at the time, James Caan had already done The Godfather.
Yeah.
So if people hadn't known him before that, they definitely fucking knew him at that point. And it's funny, too, because James Caan is one of those actors who there's always at least an ounce or two of rage behind every performance, and even in the quietest, most docile moments, like there's still just something about that guy that just kind of emanates a little bit of rage. And the scene at the beginning where they're going through the trash, and he's talking about how much his watch costs and how much his shoes cost, reminded me so much of that scene in Thief that we talked about, where he's going over like, I wear $800 shoes, I wear $1,300 suits, blah 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 blah, and I'm just like, you're really angry right now, and I don't know why. You're just describing your wardrobe, and it's just I think he kind of simmers with rage, and it works in this movie, because when you get to that final fight between him and Bean, where he's just so happy that Bean's alive and then just so pissed off that anyone let him think Bean was dead. And as an audience member, I'm going, yeah, hey, freebie, me too, because I don't know why he's still alive. Nobody's explained that. So I get it. I get why you're upset. And then it just ends with this, yeah, like you said, a Three Stooges pie fight almost in the middle of the street. And to top all of it, the guy they've been after the whole movie, the guy they've simultaneously tried to bring down, then tried to protect just so that they could bring him down, ends up dying of a heart attack.
Yeah.
Off screen. That is how inept and incompetent and useless these two guys are as cops. It's like the whole point of the movie was trying to bring this guy down, and then it was trying to protect him so you could bring him down, and then he dies off screen of a heart attack. Like minutes after he is like taken up to the press box for protection. It's like, oh no, he's dead. Why? His heart. Really? This is done. He's just gone. Deus ex heart valve.
Well, to be fair, he did just go through a really traumatic experience of, you know, meeting a girl in the park who's a floozy, who's picking him up. He's driving to go, you know, nail her, and she pulls a gun on him, and then she turns out to be a he. This is kind of one of his worst days after a really bad weekend of people coming out of the woodwork trying to kill him, and these two inept, really rude cops following him around. In fact, he's one of the funnier parts of the movie. Like, one of my favorite moments in the whole movie is, you know, Freebie and the Bean are in the tailor shop, and they're like causing a ruckus and being annoying, and like trying to be, you know, like, hey, we're you know, pulling the bullshit that, you know, like a Riggs and Murtaugh kind of thing. Like, hey, we're following you. We're on to you.
Trying to get in your head.
We're trying to get in your head. And you know, the guy who, the clerk at the tailor shop is just like, oh, I'm very sorry. You know, it's normally not this noisy in here. And he's like, oh, don't worry. They're with me.
Yeah. And at this point, like, they're just part of my entourage.
He's just blowing this whole thing off. He's just like, these cops, they're following me around. They can't fucking do anything, you know? And he's finding the whole thing funny and just kind of an annoyance at worst. Like, they're gnats who won't stop swarming him. And then, but these people keep trying to kill him, and he keeps narrowly getting out of it because of Freebie and the Bean. And then he ends up picking up a tranny at the park. And she's got a gun on him, and he's totally fucked. And that would cause an old, out-of-shape guy to have a heart attack. So I don't think that's so out of the blue. It just, the way it happens, you're just kind of like, dude.
Yeah.
Like, seriously? Like, they couldn't even keep the guy alive? Like, these guys fail at everything.
Well, and epitomized by the scene where they hear that somebody from Detroit is coming to kill him. They see Michigan plates, and they immediately attack the guy driving the car.
Actually, I thought that was a really well-orchestrated scene, because that was the scene where we see them actually being good at their job, because they're just bantering back and forth. That's what I was talking about before. You know, they're bantering. They're insulting each other for like 30 seconds, and you think they're focused on each other, and then just out of nowhere, Bean goes, Michigan plates.
Yeah.
So they go over... And they go over to talk to the guy, and the guy sees, you know, the Bean coming from behind the girl he's walking towards and goes for her. So Bean goes to grab her to protect her.
Yeah.
And it turns out these two are not hired killers.
No.
They are two lovers cheating on their spouses, getting together, who have assumed that these guys coming up must be private detectives hired by one of the spouses. and or because he's sleeping with his boss's wife.
Right.
And so everyone reacts badly in the situation and a situation escalates and then we see police brutality.
Well, not only that, but my favorite part of that scene, though, and the thing that really hits home for me, how it's you have the guy, you have the mob boss guy standing in the doorway of the barbershop watching this scene unfold with a look on his face like, wow, this is really violent. I was not prepared for how aggressive these guys are as they're beating up someone who has nothing to do with the case, as they're like literally shutting a guy's head in his car door and then taking his, my favorite line is James Caan's like, get his gun.
He has a gun.
What do you mean he has a gun?
I'm telling you, he has got a gun.
Get his ID, something, will you?
Oh!
Like, yeah, if he doesn't have a gun,
get something.
Oh, my God. And meanwhile, the mob boss is like,
this guy up and they've got nothing. And they really went over above and beyond. Because when this guy started fighting back, they're like, oh, these are definitely the killers from Detroit.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. And it's and then it becomes kind of zany again. The guy's I'm really sorry. Just don't tell the boss. It won't happen again. We know we're sinners. We shouldn't have done it. And it's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I will say another thing that really works for me about this movie is the cinematography. I think Laszlo Kovacs shot the shit out of this movie.
Oh, yeah.
It is beautiful. And there's a scene that you mentioned before, you know, where Freebie is in a situation where he thinks the guy's gotten away, he backs up, he goes a different way, you watch the two. The reason you're watching those two cars converge again is because I'm not exactly sure where he was positioned, but Kovacs uses the geography of San Francisco remarkably well.
Yes.
All of the hills, all of the very like pointed architecture on all the spires, he really does find a way. And in that shot in particular that Cargill's talking about, he's perched in such a way that he can watch from one street as one car goes one way, and then the camera can back up and turn and come from the completely other direction. It's all one shot.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's so well done. And I think that and the performances of Alan Arkin and James Caan take something that was kind of doomed from the beginning. I mean, if you have two people who are the leads in a buddy cop film in a burgeoning franchise at the time, or burgeoning genre at the time, and you're not on board with the filmmakers and the script, like, that should have been doomed to fail from the beginning. But I think because of how good it looks and because of the way that these two are playing these roles and just all of the little weird things that end up accidentally being spectacle more than anything else, I think that all of this kind of comes together to make a film that should have completely burst into flames, you know, finding a spark. And as offensive as it is, and as much as you could never remake this film, it makes it enjoyable to watch that the two people who are like the absolute worst examples of humanity are focused on ripping apart the other person they're teamed with, who is the other worst example of humanity. So ultimately, I think it balances itself out.
I think we're going to remake this as a buddy, you know, computer crime movie.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. With Hacker and the Retard, maybe. maybe, you know, 4chaner and the Mongoloid.
Something like
something less offensive, you know, for this day and age.
It's all offensive. All of it is. I do like the fact, though, that despite all of these things, despite all of the moments where this movie could have completely been derailed and burst into flames, there was still talk of a sequel.
Was there?
There was. Apparently, Alan Arkin and his representatives met with Warner Brothers to plan a sequel where not only James Caan and Alan Arkin were going to come back and play the roles, Alan Arkin was going to direct it. And part of me is like, you know, I would really like to see what those two guys in complete creative control of the movie would have been able to do, making the movie that they actually wanted to make without these weird, like, tonal bipolarism that it has at certain points, and really just going for, like, one unified direction. Kind of want to see what that movie would have looked like.
Yeah. I think would be slightly better than that?
What's that?
If they'd waited a couple more years and gotten Michael Mann to do it.
That would have been interesting. And then
like Thief Era Michael Mann.
Yeah. And working with James Caan, which has already been established to be a great thing.
And Alan Arkin.
Yeah.
and what kind of dark...
It becomes a film noir.
Yeah, yeah. Which is what that really felt like they wanted to make. Like, all of their scenes, you know, and the general plot of the movie, that movie wants to be a noir. And
then the ending wants to be Chinatown noir. Like, the ending wants to be, like, fuck everything that you thought was good about humanity noir.
Well, again, that's kind of the ending of The Long Goodbye.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that's, that. You know, it's very, like I said, it's very Altman-esque. Mm-hmm. You know, this has a lot in common with what was going on in that era, and I can definitely feel where these guys were drawing their inspiration from. And the type of films that they were feeling that they wanted to make. What this feels like is, it feels like if someone were, it feels like one of those Hitman movies from the 90s, the post-Tarantino Hitman movies, where you get two really great actors and they're like, okay, this is a Tarantino film. And the director's like, no, we're making Lethal Weapon. And they're like, no, this is a Tarantino film. And they're doing Tarantino while he's doing Shane Black. And that is what this thing is, except it's Altman in place of Tarantino.
Yeah.
And there was no Shane Black at the time.
No.
There would be no Shane Black if not for Freebie and the Bean. Freebie and the Bean is what kicked off the entire notion of the buddy cop film that then Shane Black would perfect.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, you know, we went through this whole month. We didn't talk about it because, you know, it is the single most perfect buddy cop movie.
Everybody knows Lethal Weapon. Everybody knows Lethal Weapon.
If for some reason you have not seen Lethal Weapon and you've heard us reference it over the past month, Lethal Weapon is the buddy cop movie to end all buddy cop movies.
Truth.
And I would argue that its sequel is just as good.
I even, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb. I even like Lethal Weapon 4. I enjoy that movie quite a bit. Yeah, 3, not so much. But that's really more because of the scale of the... I have a real problem with movies where the scale of the bad guy's plan is really narrow. Like, where it just seems like, really? Are you a villain or are you just kind of an asshole?
Well,
like,
4 has that really interesting production problem in which they signed Jet Li, who was just fresh out of Hong Kong at the time. Hong Kong had just changed hands. All of the Hong Kong actors came over. Some of their films had played, you know, as theatrical films here in the States. There was a burgeoning hipster young indie market exploding in the cinemas. You know, guys like me were rushing out on opening day to see these movies by Hong Kong actors that no one else had heard of. And we were just like, oh, my God. I remember when the trailer for Lethal Weapon 4 played for the first time. And I was in a packed theater and it's like, you know, Mel Gibson, the audience, and Danny Glover, and Joe Pesci, and Rene Russo, and Jet Li. And I'm like, yeah. And some redneck up front goes, who the fuck is Jet Li? And I'm just sitting there going, all right, but yeah,
this is our lives, by the way.
So Jet Li had signed on to the film, but couldn't speak a lick of English.
Yeah.
So they split his character off.
Technically, it's a Rick. It's a Rick of English. What, we're talking about Freebie and the Bean, and I can't make a joke?
No.
Come on, damn
no,
it. Fine.
No, you cannot.
Fine.
They literally, Uncle Benny was supposed to be the same character as his enforcer. Like, it was one character, and they couldn't do it, so they split it into two. And you really feel that throughout that film. I'm not a big fan of 4, but I love 1 and 2.
I like 4 quite a bit.
But those would not exist if not for Freebie and the Bean.
And one thing I did, we talked about how this movie and last week's movie, Running Scared, have a lot in common. Both of them are very much indelible to the city in which they are set. Both of them thrive on the virtue of the performances of the two leads more so than the story.
Neither of them have plots.
Neither of them really have a lot of plots to speak of. I don't know. This movie, I guess this movie also doesn't really have a straight man situation. Like, they're both kind of completely whacked. And then the other thing is, this movie was supposed to... They were going to distribute the film early in 1974, but they decided not to do that because they didn't want to compete with a film called Busting, which was directed by last week's director, Peter Hyams. So there's a lot of really strange connections, in fact, between Freebie and the Bean and Running Scared. Spiritual successors, one to the other, sure. Definitely a double feature you should check out, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And, yeah, you probably guessed it, but I'm going to go...
Come on. This is a layup.
It is, but I'm going to add a twist to it, because I know that you are thinking taco, but I'm going to say peaches and tacos, because those two things don't go together at all. At all.
Except in Austin.
Except in Austin.
Where we have the peach tortilla.
Which is an amazing restaurant, and that is the whole point, folks. Peaches and tacos should not go together. Nothing about this movie should work. Nothing about this movie really does go together. And yet at the end of the day, somehow, like the peach tortilla in Austin, this movie is amazingly satisfying despite being so weird. And that is exactly the film you have with Freebie and the Bean. Again, it's going to offend you. Like, this movie is going to bug you, and you're not going to like these two guys very much, and you're not going to like yourself for how much you like these guys by the end of the movie. But just give it a chance, because Freebie and the Bean is one of the granddaddy buddy cop movies, and that's why we're ending this month on this note.
You know, I didn't mention this earlier, but the first time I saw this film was when Edgar Wright brought it to town. Edgar Wright made his send-up of buddy comedies, Hot Fuzz, and he programmed an event at the Draft House where he played a bunch of his favorite buddy cop films. He played Sudden Impact. He played Bad Boys 2.
Sudden Impact is so good.
And he played Freebie and the Bean. And then followed it up with Hot Fuzz. And it was such a weird, it was the perfect way to see it. You know, it was the old original Alamo Draft House. You know, Edgar Wright wasn't a huge name by then. He'd only made the one film and had already been to Austin several times. And it was so cool to see on 35, but it's one of those oddball film lover oddities that you have to take in.
Absolutely. And hey, guys, that's going to do it for Buddy Cop July. I hope you've enjoyed the ride, or I guess I should say the ride along. But we're going to go ahead.
Why did you do that?
Because cops and ride-alongs and puns
and that was
and,
a movie
and
from
Brian Salisbury.
This year?
No. I'm going to pretend that movie doesn't exist because that's one of the worst Buddy Cop movies.
That movie doesn't exist. Keep pretending.
One of the worst Buddy Cop movies ever. But if you want to hear more of us, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at Twitter at twitter.com/massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at facebook.com/massawyrm.
Killer. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also find me at oneofus.net, my home away from home. A lot of great geek podcasts and blogs for every taste. No matter what you're into, we've got something for it. Check out oneofus.net. I wanted to end this show on a really progressive note, like some kind of joke that would actually uplift humanity and not resort to stereotypes. But then I remembered that I just watched this movie like twice in the last couple days and all of the jokes in my head are just awful.
Yeah.
So let's just end it. Let's end it in a slap fight. We're going to have a slap fight. And we'll be right back next week with bruises and cuts and scars.